bleak, barren, inner-city tarmac of University Avenue, we return to your radio road hazard, the Mischke Broadcast, transmitting live from the city of St. Paul, courtesy of the talk station, AM 1500, KSTP.
Thank you. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Mischke Broadcast. It's not often that we have an opportunity to talk to an American treasure. We do have such an opportunity tonight. He's played gangsters in daytime radio, appeared in federal theater, acted in such films as John Sayles' Eight Men Out. He's found time to write 8 books of oral history, including the Pulitzer Prize winning The Good War. His most recent book, My American Century, is a collection of his best interviews. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a recipient of a Presidential National Humanities Medal, as well as a National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. And he's author of a book just out right now called The Spectator. The Spectator is a wonderful recap of all sorts of interviews this man has done over the years with various playwrights and actors and directors. It's a first-hand look at these dancers, these lyricists, others who have created the dramatic arts of the past half century. You know him. We all know him. His name is Studs Terkel. Thank you, Studs, for joining us tonight. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here.
Just coming back from a visit with your buddy Garrison Keillor, I understand.
He's a remarkable man. Garrison Keillor is about as close as we come today to wearing the mantle of Mark Twain. And he's known, by the way, throughout the world. It's just not his humor that is both light and dark. It's his understanding of the human comedy, both the light and the dark. And that's why he's remarkable. As a writer, by the way, as well as a performer, it's a combination of both. And I think he's, when I say Mark Twain, I'm not exaggerating. He has that quality of capturing the feeling of the human heart.
Speaking of writing and being on radio, you've had an opportunity over the years to do quite a bit of both. I'm wondering, your radio show, which you did for 45 years, certainly showed a lot of people that that medium was a love of yours.
I find radio far more exciting and TV. I was on television in the early pioneer days in Chicago when it was 1950, when TV was on 6 to 10 at night, and from the West Coast came hardly anything. Chicago had 3 programs, Garraway at Large, with Dave Garraway, whose name may be remembered by some and not by others. He was the first face ever seen on daytime TV when a new program came into being called Today. Until that time, it was at night. Well, Dave had a show in Chicago. He was his jazz disc jockey, as I was, in the late 40s. And then the other program was called Kukrafan Ali, with a genius named Bert Hillstrom. He had little rags in his hand and created this whole world for the Kukrapolitans. The third was a program I was involved with called Stud's Place. And all three were improvised, and there was no such thing as canned laughter. It was happening at that moment. And so that was part of my checkered career. But radio, I find, calls for the imagination, the listener. When you listen, people listen to you right now, they imagine what I look like, or if I tell a story, they'd imagine that story, whereas if it's on TV, it's all acted out for them, you see. And there's no imagination involved in that sense.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I thought of when I was reading the interviews in your book, The Spectator, is I wondered how different it would have been if I had been there. In your radio interviews, you got to hear the pauses, you got to hear the inflection, you got to hear the tone. In a print interview, the answer follows right after the question, and it's often difficult to know whether or not...
Why, you see, I work as though I write, as I don't write, the words of others. I write in introductions, but it's as though the words, as though you're hearing the voice. I try to capture the idea of the voice jumping at you from the page. I should point out that my reputation has been as something called an oral historian. Mm-hmm. an oral historian preceded, you know, me and preceded printing word, the printed word, written word by centuries. The oral historian was the first one to tell the story. He's the shaman, the medicine man around the campfire centuries ago. Then came the pen. Then came the printing press. And now we have every sort of thing. But I have the tape recorder at my side. And so even though the tape recorder has been my ally, I know nothing about it. I'm very bad technically. I'm very inept. I can't drive a car, so I goof up on the tape recorder. Mm-hmm. But I'm passionate about the tape recorder. Only one other person has been that passionate about tape recorder. You know who?
Let me guess. Alan Lomax? No.
Richard Nixon. You see, Nixon and I were both taken with a tape recorder for different reasons, I hope. I'll come to Alan Lomax in a moment, the great musicologist. But Nixon and I, we know the old phrase of Descartes. We'd get this in school. I think, therefore I am. So I say, Nixon and I call us as neo-Cartesians. I tape, therefore I am. But in any event, this new book is different from the other books. The other books I did, Hard Times about the Depression, or The Good War about World War II. It's in quotes, by the way. No war is good. It makes savages of us all. The working jobs people do. Well, all this is about so-called ordinary people. And the irony is, I've been celebrated for celebrating the non-celebrated. Now, the new book is about celebrated people, not celebrities. I hate that word. But people are celebrated for their skill. Buster Keaton and silent films. Brando for his work. Federico Fellini, the Italian director. Ruth Gordon. Carol Channing, who surprises you with her brilliance about interpreting characters. So that I approach them the same way, just as I'd approach a parking lot attendant or a school teacher. I approach these artists the same way. So the new book differs in that respect.
Let's take a look at one of these interviews. I was fascinated by the one with Brando. One of the things that occurs in your interview with Brando is he turns the tables on you and starts interviewing you.
That's right. You see, he was tough. That is, he didn't want to talk about his work. And I was very moved by him, but he was turning, he said, why am I doing what I'm doing? And so we got into sort of a duel, but mostly he talked about himself and the world in which we live. He's a commodity, he says. He's someone who has become a piece of property. He was putting himself down at the same time describing the world in which we live. And he was also trying to explain the sadness of when people are asking autographs. Why do they need that? He tried to tell it to his kid. It's sort of a talisman. It was quite moving. But the others I find very revealing about their work. Carol Channing, for example, plays a dumb blonde. We think she's dumb blonde, but she's brilliant. And she analyzes, you know, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, you know, the song. Lorelei Lee, who lives off the butter and egg man, a sugar daddy. Well, she shows she's as tough and shrewd as the sharpest businessman. She can make, you know, the cover of Business Week. She analyzed this role. And Zero Mostel, the great comic, of course, was a great clown offstage, and so I had to keep up with him. But the one I couldn't stop, you can realize I talk a lot and fast, but I couldn't get a word in with guess whom? The mime, Marcel Marceau. Marcel Marceau, who was so brilliant without words, couldn't stop talking.
Now, some of the folks you talked to said things that were quite surprising. Others seemed to reinforce a sort of a stereotype. James Cagney, who would have ever thought that his dream was to be a farmer in life? Wasn't he a city boy, a tough neighborhood?
He was raised and was known as Hell's Kitchen, and he talked about, you see, I had personal reason interviewing him because it was my city, Chicago, that became the city boom boom thanks to Warner Brothers, Jimmy Cagney in Public Enemy, and Edward G. Robbins in Little Caesar. And as a result of which, I was kind of kidding him about what you've done to my city. But he was analyzing his work. He came from Hell's Kitchen, and he said, what do you want to know about the guys who didn't go to the chair? He did know guys who went to the chair. But I said, how did you get these phrases? You know, what do you hear? What do you say? He says, well, once upon a time, a friend of mine knew a hooker, and she used that phrase. But then I asked how you came to dance and do what you do. He says, it's just a job. I don't know. He would put himself down. He's very mild-mannered and gentle. And at the time I saw him, he was losing it a little. He was ill, was diabetic. At the same time, You ask a certain question. I knew that he painted a little.
Mm-hmm.
And he painted a prize fighter. One of those films like Furpo, knocking Dempsey out of the ring, that kind of thing. And then I realized I'll call upon the name of an old-time prize fighter. Do you remember Jimmy McLarnon? No. Of course he did. And I opened up all kinds of avenues. That's how I work, you see. And he was analyzed. The key moment he's known for best is, if people remember this, those who see replay of Public Enemy on TV, he's with this girl. He's a gangster.
Mm-hmm.
And he's tired of this girl, played by Mae Clark, an actress, because he's in love with Jean Harlow, whom he met. So she's whining, and they're having breakfast, and takes the grapefruit, and he shoves it right in her puss. Now, that was a shocking thing. I said, how did that happen? He says, it was an accident. I didn't mean to do it. Supposed to throw some scrambled eggs at it, but they were too messy, and I saw the grapefruit, and so he's describing how accidents used to happen in films. Buster Keaton is a master describing that in silent films. So I found that a very fascinating adventure.
Buster Keaton offers some advice on if you're going to throw a pie somewhere on who to avoid.
See, Buster Keaton, first of all, some of these great silent films were not scripted. Mm-hmm. There's a beginning, middle, end. A lot of it was improvised. Even extras pitched in. And he and Charlie Chaplin had contests. Who could have the least subtitles? You know, subtitles, mm-hmm. the words written below. Who could have the least? I mean, you could show the most through mime.
Right.
And sometimes there were 300 subtitles. Well, Chaplin beat him, but I think with about 35, and he had about 40. But it was the idea of, but the matter of pies, there was certain ritual. You could throw a pie at a pretty girl, that was okay. Throw a pie at a gangster, at a big shot. You could throw a pie even at an old woman, if she were a dowager. Like, remember Margaret Dumont? She was a famous one who was the stooge of Groucho Marx. And at her, but not at a gentle old lady. But you could not throw a pie. Milton Berle once threw a pie on the Ed Sullivan Show. He had a Sunday Sullivan Show, did, mm-hmm. which all kinds of stars appeared. And Milton Berle threw a pie at Ed Sullivan, and the crowd froze up. There are certain people at whom you do not throw pies.
Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger was one of those people who said what, in fact, I would have guessed he would have said in one of his films. I didn't realize he was quite so much like his characters in real life. Here's from your book, California is to me a dreamland. It's the absolute combination of everything I was always looking for. It has all the money in the world. There are show business people there, wonderful weather, beautiful country, ocean, snow skiing in the winter. You can go in the desert on the same day. You have beautiful-looking people. They all have a tan. I'm a strong believer in Western philosophy, the philosophy of success, of progress, of getting rich. The Eastern philosophy is passive. I believe in that maybe 3% of the time. The 97% is Western, conquering and going on. It's a beautiful philosophy, and America should keep it up.
I let him expose himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call indecent exposure. I deliberately had him in for a certain reason. He's the one I least respect. I had him in for a certain reason. What is success? See, it's followed a chapter involving Eugene O'Neill, the playwright, the powerful playwright who had such tragedy and described it, and Jason Robards, and the director, who Robards was a great O'Neill actor in plays, and the director, Quintero, describing failure, the sense of failure, and what is success. And hit the success. This guy, that's success, to be number one. Name on the marquee. All that money. Be big. In contrast, with an actress named Uta Hagen, a wonderful actress who could have been a big star, but she has a little company in New York. Success to her is reaching out to people as an actress, as an artist, and maybe in one way or another touching upon their lives. That's why I had him in for it, you see. The irony is a lot of the young kids, the only person they recognize it's Schwarzenegger. These are most of the first half century.
Mm-hmm. You seem to admire the rest of the people interviewed in this book.
Oh, I do.
In fact, I found myself wondering whether or not you ever interview people you don't admire.
Oh, well, I've done in the past books, the oral histories. I want to capture what life is, you know. And so I once interviewed Gerald L. K. Smith before you were born. He was leading, he called himself American Fascist and Anti-Semite. And he was very, by the way, very eloquent. And I interviewed him because I wanted to capture him. And he let him talk. I let him talk about himself. And see, I think there are all kinds of possibilities. If I can wander away from this book a minute to talk, people ask me, who is the most exciting person I ever interviewed? Mm-hmm. And I might say Bertrand Russell. I saw him in North Wales. I might say, he was good, but not it. I might say Chief Albert John Luthuli, who was the predecessor of Nelson Mandela in South Africa, during apartheid days. Remarkable man. But the one I found the most fascinating, people can change. Could I talk about 5 minutes about
sure,
this?
Sure.
Was the Grand Cyclops, former Grand Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan of Durham, North Carolina. I had to interview this man because I read somewhere a two-line...
Now, did they call him the Grand Cyclops or the Grand Wizard?
Well, Grand Cyclops or Grand Dragon.
Oh, okay.
But he was the big shot.
All right.
Seemingly, of the Ku Klux Klan. Why did I choose him as the one the most interesting? Well, I saw a little item in the paper somewhere about a former Grand Cyclops, this man, mm-hmm. C.P. Ellis, and a black woman named Ann Atwater traveling around the country advocating unions, janitorial unions. I said, I got to meet him. And so here's his story. Poor white. His life is so miserable and wretched. He has a kid who's got retarded, and he loves his kid. And he tries a milk route and fails. Gas station fails. He's a failure. Who's to blame? I'll use the bad word now. Nigger. Because that's what he's been taught all his life. You see, if your life is miserable, there's got to be somebody below you so you can survive the day, but you wouldn't make it, you see. So then he joins the Klan. And he goes, describes the Klan. He says, you know what? Here am I, a poor white. They put that white sheet on me in that hood. And I'm walking down this corridor, for the people there, towards that illuminated cross. And I take the vow, he says, and I felt I was somebody. Get this. That's the same phrase Jesse Jackson uses when he talks to the congregation. And you are somebody, but used for different reasons. Jesse does it to make people feel self-esteem. Whereas he used it to be better than somebody else. This poor guy. Now he becomes a Klansman. And now it's civil rights time, the 60s. And as one person in the world he hates the worst, and that's a woman named Ann Atwater. She's an African-American woman who leads the picket lines in Durham, maybe the 60s now, to get the stores to hire black clerks. And he'd break up those picket lines, no bloody battles. Now, at this same time, Jimmy Carter's president, and a couple of $1 million comes to Durham to the school system for the libraries. And there's a black guy on a committee that's, for some reason, integrated, or the schools are all segregated. This black guy, this African-American, says, every parent of every student is invited to the meeting. And he invites the NAACP and the Ku Klux Klan. He invites Martin Luther King's group and the White Citizens Council. It's a crazy idea. And this guy, C.P. Ellis, says, I'm going to go to that. And his friends say, you crazy, you're going to go with them? He says, look, she, Ann Atwater's got a girl going to school there. I got a boy going to school. I'll have her talk and me not there, and her kid advantage over me. I got to go. And that meeting is wild. He and she are at each other. People calling each other names and Ray. He's telling his story. And suddenly one guy gets up, an African-American, says, I like CPL. I think he's an honest man. And as he's telling me the story, it's kind of funny. He goes, now, what's this guy doing to me? This black guy. See, I'm an honest man. He's turning me upside down or something. Well, the wind-up is somebody says, you got to have a committee because we can't go on this way. And so someone says, I nominate Ann Atwater as chair of the committee, someone says. And this African-American guy says, and I nominate C.P. Ellis as co-chair. Well, this is crazy. And both of them look at each other, and somebody says, you've got to meet on this thing. You hate each other. So they agree. Don't even shake hands. But she's got a girl going to school. He's got a boy going to school. Now they start meeting. And now as he's telling me the story, something is happening to him. He's starting to gulp. And he says, Ann said this. Ann, no, he's calling her Ann. And one day she comes in a-crying. What are you crying about, Ann? She says, well, my little girl with segregated schools, a black school. Little girl was buked and scorned and kidded and laughed at because her mother's going around with a Klansman. And she starts crying. And suddenly he starts crying. At my boy in the white school. They threw sticks and stones at him because his father's going around with a black woman agitator. Next thing you know, they're holding on to each other. They're in the same boat. They realize that. In the meantime, he's experienced certain little epiphanies, little revelations. Every night when he broke up that picket line, he'd get a call from a big shot in town. And a big shot would say, "You did good, CP, you did good." Well, he sees one of those guys walking down the street toward him. He thinks the guy's going to shake his hand. The guy sees C.P. Ellis, and he crosses over to the other side of the street. That's when C.P. says, wait a minute, am I being used? This guy don't want to be seen with me. And then I see a black guy going by. He's as raggedy as I am. Is he the one keeping me down? These things are happening. And now he gets a job as a janitor at Duke University. Duke is in Durham. And he turns out to be a pretty good organizer of unions. He's getting cards. The union is 80% black women. 80% black women. I'm almost near the end of the story. 80%. And he's one of the white guys, but he's a very good organizer. He wants to run for... He finally found his calling, union organizer. He wants to run for a full-time job as business agent or something. He said, "I'm not going to win because my opponent is black." So he gets up to talk. He says, "You know who I am, C.P. Ellis?" And the women all say, "Sit down, we know who you are. You know, the company sent out that leaflet with me in a white robe and all that." And he says, "Sit down, we know who you are, sit down." He thinks he's going to lose, and that's when he can hardly talk. He says, "Those women, they elected me 4-1. They knew my heart. It's me and those women, we've had little education, but you know what? We hold our own. When those big shots come to town, those lawyers of the company, we negotiate with them. And now I feel like I'm somebody." Well, that story to me is biblical in its power. Mm-hmm. It's got sin, revelation, transcendence, redemption. Mm-hmm. So that's one of my favorites. That tells me people can change.
Has he ever been made aware of the fact that of the... all the people you've interviewed, all the decades of interviewing, that his story stands out?
Well, he's in a couple of my books.
Okay.
Yeah, he's in, of these books, he's in Single American Dreams, Lost and Found, One Called Race.
It's a wonderful story. And we'll be back with Studs Terkel.
The ground. Somebody's got a hold on you. Yeah, they got a hold on your everyday life. A hold on your friends and your relatives too. Oh, they got a hold on your children and your wife. Hey, they sell you on the television, and they sell you on the radio. They sell you in the only way that they can. Oh, they come knocking.
Welcome back to the Mishki Broadcast. We're here talking to Studs Terkel.
Yes, everybody's going for the money, and I think it makes the world go round. This old world, it keeps a turning on and on. Yes, when you're laying underneath the ground. Somebody's got a hold on you. Yeah, they got a hold on your everyday life. A hold on your friends and your relatives too. Oh, they got a hold on your children and your wife. Hey, they sell you on the television, and they sell you on the radio. They sell you in the only way that they can. Oh, they come knocking on your front.
Welcome back to the Mishki Broadcast. We're here talking to Studs Terkel, who's in town. His new book, The Spectator, which is a series of interviews with studs, everybody from Carol Channing to Marlon Brando, some of the great showbiz folks of the first half of the 20th century, and some that crept into the second half of the 20th century. We were trying to figure out during the break, I was trying to figure out how Bill Veeck crept into this book. And maybe you can tell us why he's in there.
Association. One voice may lead to another. See, Bill Veeck, we know Bill Veeck, who was the one independent spirit among baseball owners, once told me, a place called Miller's Pub, Our time is over, studs. We individuals, corporate guys can take over. Faceless guys will take over. Committees will take over. And of course, he was right. But Bill Veeck was also a literate man. He'd go to plays. He read books. And so, you know, the exploding scoreboard, he was known for little tricks. Mm-hmm. The scoreboard would explode when when he was general manager of the White Sox. When a guy would, the Sox were in terrible shape. But once a guy hits a home run, the home guy, the crowd goes crazy. For one moment, they are victors. For one moment, the losers are winners. He got that idea in watching a play by William Saroyan. Saroyan was a playwright of the 30s who wrote about the Depression. And one of his plays, famous one, is called Time of Your Life. It was a movie later on with Jimmy Cagney, but very miscast. Time of Your Life was about a tavern in San Francisco where all the losers are there. And there's a kid named Willie who plays the pinball machine. He never wins. Willie's there, and then once he hits the jackpot, and the band plays Dixie and the flags are unfurled and he's jumping up and down. He won that moment. At that moment, I switched then from William Saroyan to Bill Veeck, whom I was talking to, seemingly unrelated, in the barge room at Comiskey Park. I connected. Veeck says he got the idea of the exploding scoreboard, seeing that scene in Saroyan's play, Time of Your Life. So that's how I work. It's free association.
Mm-hmm. A lot of folks around here know Bill's son, Mike, pretty well because of his owning the local minor league ball club, the St. Paul Saints. You knew Mike, too? And I was also talking to you during the break about some other folks who used to stumble into your house. Woody Guthrie used to spend time
with
you?
Was way back in the days of organizing the CIO, Industrial Union, during the New Deal days of FDR. John L. Lewis, the mine workers, was leading, you know, industrial unions. And so Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and a guy named Lee Hayes, another guy, a fourth guy, Mel Ampel, would travel by car. They had no dough. And they'd sing these labor songs at rallies, at picket lines, picnics, and they'd stay at homes of people who were sympathetic to the unions. And so I just married my wife. She was an aristocrat. She was a social worker, making $125 a month. That's why I married her, because she was making it. She's so rich, $125 a month. And so we had 2.5 rooms, and they stayed with us for 12 days. The three guys sleep on the floor, one guy in the Davenport, and we were in a Murphy bed. And Woody was so brilliant, and he would write songs at the top of a hat, and he could write them. He wrote for the government, for the Columbia Valley Authority way back. He'd write a song a day, just flow out of him, almost like Mozart in his own way. And I remember that very well. Those are moments.
You also interview in this book some folks who, in one particular case, you don't interview the person you don't necessarily care for, but you talk about them, and that's Michael, is it Cimino?
Well, that was the movie called The Deer Hunter that everybody praised and loved. It won every award in the book. At the time I saw that, I couldn't figure what they won the award. It was a horrible movie. It was racist in every way. These guys were evil. There wasn't one good North Vietnamese in the lot playing Russian. And I found that also it was describing an ethnic Croatian or a Serbian wedding, you know, the deer hunter or miners. I've been to a lot of those weddings because when I did these books about the non-celebrated people, of course I attended. You name any ethnic group, attended all the weddings. There was certain dignity. Sure, there were a couple of drunken fights, as they had here. But there was certain dignity and memories there that were lacking in this. So I wrapped that. And then I described that in contrast to wonderful anti-war movies that were really great.
Are those you interview generally honest with you? Are they trying to give you the bare truth as they see it, or at times is there a sense of kind of a self-serving deception with some of them?
Well, I think as far as the actors and the singers and the writers, I was just asking them about specific plays, whether it be Tennessee Williams or whether it be Arthur Miller or whether it be a director like the Italian Federico Fellini. So specific stuff. Now, the big question is about the non-celebrated people, say, talking about the Depression. Did they make that up? Well, I feel it was their truth. They said it. You see, even though there may have been some exaggeration here and there, it's a basic truth. And remember, it was not only said by them, but by others of the same situation, interviewed separately and differently. There's a great line in Grapes of Wrath. when Tom Joad, remember the Great Wrath, the Oklahoma family, Okies go looking for a job, and the guy comes back, and he's all starved back home, because there are no jobs out in California there. You know, they got, they, you get 5,000 leaflets, 200 jobs, and one guy says, is he telling the truth? His truth. Is it ours? We'll find out. And it was. So in a sense, that's what it's about.
Of all the actors and actresses who have made an impression on you, you mentioned in the book that your favorite, well, actually, you mentioned two, Charlie Chaplin and Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, that's very funny. I was 18 in 1930 when Spencer Tracy broke into movies, along with Jimmy Cagney, the same year. And I remember a funny comedy he was in. Chaplin, of course, to me, he's one of the earliest ones I saw way back with Shoulder Arms. But Chaplin is what movies were all about. He's the one who started The Magic Lantern. His picture, the little tramp, that face image, was more known over the world than Jesus Christ, Buddha, and Muhammad. All. Charlie Chaplin, the little tramp, was to be found in magic lanterns in those days. Back in Tierra del Fuego, way, way south, or in Arctic territory, or in the Congo, or somewhere in the frozen north. You found that. So Chaplin, to me, was the all-around. He was everything. He wrote, directed, and did all.
And what about Tracy? What was it about him?
Well, Tracy had introduced a new quality in acting, a casual throwaway, almost artless, as though he weren't acting, you see. Mm-hmm. He came from the stage, and until he came along, act as big gestures, generally. He did it as though he wasn't acting, and no doubt you're probably asking what he was doing. He says, I'm just talking, you know. Mm-hmm. So he introduced that form I call artless art.
What is the difference in your mind between the radio medium and television?
I like radio so much more exciting. For one thing, you and I are talking right now, and the audience is listening. Now, if we were on TV, they'd be watching us and watching us do one thing or another. The best example I have, you know, there was a man named Marshall McLuhan, who was a brilliant man, but whom I disagreed with. He called TV the cool medium. Cool, it's a jazz term, cool against hot. Mm-hmm. Cool meaning cerebral, calls upon your mind. Hot being, well, it's exactly the opposite. Radio is the cool medium, because you have, the audience has to imagine. I remember hearing Dylan Thomas, the great Welsh poet, a long narrative poem called Under Milkwood. It's about a Welsh town, morning to night. You hear the voice of the narrator, Richard Burton, or maybe Dylan Thomas, and you imagine these people, what they look like. You imagine it. You imagine the town. Then I saw it on TV, and it was a very good cast, except it wasn't my people, you see. Mm-hmm. A certain actress did Polly Garter. A certain actor did The Blind Captain. They weren't mine. So, you see, TV is the hot medium, and radio is the cool medium. In radio, you and I can talk, put music in. We can imagine our imagination. Words count more. Words.
You are 87 years old. You're going to be 88 this year in May. It's a new century, a new millennium. If there was something you could take from the 20th century into this century, what would it be? What one thing would you like to drag along from that last century?
Oh, boy.
Probably plenty.
I got to watch out for too much technology, too. I worry about that. I do because I myself am very inept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I told you.
You don't drive a car. Never have.
Never. Except once in a movie. It was by a Jane Fonda movie called The Dollmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I had two lines. And the reason I was in it is because the director, the movie director of the show I told you about, Studs Place, name was Daniel Petrie. And they're going to do it in Chicago. And she's an Appalachian woman, comes out of the depot with four kids, husband's got a job. The scene in the novel is Detroit, but the husband's got a job in the defense plant. And so I'm parked there, two lines, and they say, oh, that's great, that's terrific. And then the director says, now you drive out. I says, drive out, are you crazy? Do you remember in Studs Place we had a running gag, I never drove a car. She says, oh my God, I forgot about, you know what they did? They hired a stand-in to drive the car. Now, I challenge you to name any actor, name any star, with two lines who had a stand-in. So I'm unique.
Studs Terkel is my guest. The book is The Spectator, and it's talk about movies and plays with those who made them. He's going to be appearing tomorrow at the Weyerhaeuser Chapel at McAllister College, which is over on Grand Avenue in St. Paul. There's no admission. It's free, and he'll be signing books and reading from the book. This is put on by Ruminator Books, formerly Hungry Mind, and we'll be back. The book is The Spectator, talk about movies and plays with those who made them. You're still a Chicago guy, always have been.
Oh, home, yeah, my home. Been there, 8 years old, moved there. And that hotel my mother ran, if my father died, was near the Loop, near the downtown theater section. Mm-hmm. That's why I got into be a playgoer and a moviegoer at the age of 13. Because the press agent would give you a couple of ducats mm-hmm. to put a poster in the lobby. And, of course, the guys at the hotel never wanted to see plays. They could maybe Gypsy Rose Lee, but that's it, you know.
Do you remember the Carl Sandburg poem? I think it was called Chicago.
Oh, Chicago, City of Broad Shoulders.
Does that still apply today?
I think, we lost a lot. Remember, the industrial and industries have all left and gone to town where there's, you know, no union slave labor and technology. But it's still hog butcher of the world, stacker of wheat, center of the nation's railroads. Once upon a time, Chicago had 1,000 passenger trains passing through each day. 1,000 passenger trains. But it's still a remarkable city as far as architecture is concerned. The skyscraper was originated in Chicago, you know.
Yeah. 88 years old in May, and you have 3 more books planned.
Well, my publisher is crazily optimistic, is he not? Yeah.
What would be the next one?
The next one, well, this is called The Listener, dealing with people, actors and writers and movies, and the others would be Listener. Some of the opera singers I've interviewed, some of the folk singers, some of the jazz artists, the large.
You interviewed
Armstrong.
Dylan?
I knew Duke Metcalf, but didn't interview him for tape, unfortunately. But it got Earl Hines and Dizzy Gillespie in a while. And so it's a combination. That might be called The Listener.
Mm-hmm.
And the third, well, this is crazy, of course. Third is called The Reader, involving authors and poets I've had on others.
Crazy only that you'd be about 95.
I'd be 95, 96, and I said to the publisher, what happens next? And he says, we'll talk about that further. So that's known as optimism in a crazy sort of way. In any event, if we're going to sign off, people ask what my epitaph is going to be, and I say, my epitaph is, curiosity did not kill this cat.
Studs Terkel, quite a life. The book is called The Spectator, and as a spectator of some of the accomplishments in your life, I just want to say thank you for all you've done, for all you've contributed, not only to letters, but to this country.
Well, thank you very much.
Great been, American treasure.
Been a delight being with you.
Studs Terkel. See him tomorrow. Weyerhaeuser Chapel. That's your headphone, not mine. Oh, you got it turned up pretty high there. Here, the headset here that Stud has on is the loudest I've ever heard. I've never heard anyone quite have it up that high. KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time Minneapolis. Thanks.
You have the best car stereo money can buy. You have a 6-disc CD changer, digital multicolor LCD display, 3-band parametric equalizer with 3-stage loudness control, front and rear stereo preamp outputs with auxiliary amplifiers, and a high-pass filter in use as a dedicated subwoofer, and the latest generation digital super tuner with System Q sound control. And here you are, listening to AM Talk Radio. Good choice. Quality equipment demands quality content. The Talk Station, AM 1500 KSTP. We'd like to take this time to salute the unheralded star of the Talk Station, you, the caller. Sitting there, minding your own business, when one of our hosts says something that stirs your soul so much, you leap to the phone and give them what for. This would not be a Talk Station if not for you, so call us anytime.
Callers may not exceed one call per week. Calling the host at home constitutes a violation of stalking laws in 39 states and may be subject to criminal prosecution and an extended jail sentence. Don't screw with us.
Our eternal gratitude to you, the beloved caller.
The Talk Station, AM 1500 KST.
KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time, Minneapolis. Sleep well, folks. From ABC News.